Your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway.
Parental discretion is advised.
Greetings and welcome to Technology Bites.
I was just noticing that you still have your goggles on.
I thought he'd just put those on just for this.
It's possible. He's kind of like, who is the character from Kelly's Heroes?
Mm-hmm. All I'm thinking
Sutherland,
of is
Sutherland's character in Kelly's Heroes. You remember the movie?
I'm thinking Hogan's Heroes.
I know nothing.
Family Feud.
Richard Dawson.
All right.
That guy from 1 Adam 12.
Oddball. Oddball.
I never saw it, I guess.
Well, it wasn't wearing actual goggles. He's just got a tank commander helmet on. But that's you. Okay, Rommel, fine.
The Desert Fox. Yeah, yeah.
Kinda, yeah.
What about, like, Hellboy?
He has goggles.
Do you have stumps growing out of your head?
Maybe.
Are those goggles supposed to look like the horn stumps? They kind of do.
All right, welcome to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
Inflicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's...
Hellboy.
Perfect show.
Yes. Lee is out tonight. He made
some
lame excuse and bailed on us, so...
I'm going to do a crawfish boil, I think.
Really? Yeah, why not?
That was all it took?
Hey, free crawfish.
Hey, does anyone have an external mouse? I think my laptop just gave up the ghost.
Oh,
like, the trackpad's
no.
dead. On the show. That's so sad.
Were you ground?
Did it
you
was working
provide
this
a little
morning.
Static electricity to your
yeah.
machine?
That's just...
It's just...
Flicted's checking.
It's got like a little bit of activity, but not.
Blow on it. Maybe it's dirty.
Here, hold on. Let's do the
get the dust out from the little sensors. There you go.
Nope. Not really. It's almost like it's glitchy. Like there's a software issue, but I think it's hardware.
Power cycle. Turn it off and on.
This is the second time. Yeah. Have you tried turning it off and on again? I'll try it one more time.
I've got a RJ45 to DB9.
I don't even have a DB9 mouse.
I have a USB to DB9, but it's the wrong
That's a toothbrush.
That's a sonic screwdriver.
Got some fiber cleaner.
What is that?
It cleans fiber optic cables.
Yeah, it's fiber cleaner.
Oh, I see.
You can also use it to floss.
Push it.
That's amazing that you have these things in your bag.
Your tech bag of tricks.
Well, while Flicked digs around to see if he has a mouse, I don't carry a mouse. That's just amazing.
I mean, I can go keyboard shortcuts. I'm fine.
Like a Cisco cable.
That's what I'm thinking. We can go RJ45 to Cisco to DB9 to DB25.
To a
PS2 to USB, and then we still don't have a mouse.
Yeah, if I hadn't cleaned up my bag, I usually don't have. I
have a ball mouse, but no ball.
Is your not a touchscreen?
I don't even use a mouse for any of my machines, but I was working at one of the places that I do support, and I had a USB mouse in my bag earlier in the week, but then it was like, you know, what's this doing here? Taking up space, taking up weight.
Mini display port to HDMI display port or DVI.
Nice.
So he can watch his unhappy screen on the TV set. There could be that.
Oh, well.
Wasn't there a mouse connected to that computer?
Yeah,
I can go.
I don't know where it's connected to, but I need it.
You need it.
Look in that room over there.
Look in that room over there. Just muscle your way in past that woman.
Remote.
Apple remote.
That might act like a...
There are so many things in Flicked's bag, none of them useful. But it's kind of impressive what he's pulling out. You know, if you could see this at home, listeners.
This is not everyday carry kind
this
of
is not the
USB hub.
This is not the kind of stuff that you carry around with yours. I mean, why are you so burdened with this stuff? You just added so much weight, unnecessary weight to your bag, to your kit.
What's that?
He's got a. It looks like a phone charger.
Oh, it's got the like nylon, the fake kind of the cord. It's the.
He's got this charger that's a mini.
To get a charger cord that has the
micro
looks like the old,
micro USB, and it looks like one of those old cords that you'd see on your grandmother's iron.
Yeah, it's a cloth wrapped
cable,
lightning bolt connector.
That's impressive. All right. All right, so Flicked is digging through his bag of
that's
useless
our new,
tricks.
That's our new segment, What's in the Bag, Flicked?
All right, you can visit us online at geekradio.com, with or without a mouse. Well, and you can also hang out with us on IRC, irc.cuckoo.com, in the channel Tech Bites. It is the show within a show, and you are welcome to go there. You know, if you are listening to this show in the podcast... If you listen to this show in the podcast or you listen to it rebroadcast on one of the other radio stations, you might, if you're interested in the IRC, I know we're not there. Obviously, we're not in the channel doing anything if we happen to be in the channel when the show's not on. But if you set up your client from 8 to 10 on Wednesdays Central Standard Time to log into the IRC channel and log the channel, you can get all the text and scroll through it later. So still no joy, huh?
No, I found a rat trap with no rats nor mice.
Did you look in the
everything was
in the front room, that big room? There's like a Mac that sits off to the side on the counter.
I didn't look at the Mac.
Oh, there. Yeah.
Although
it may be
to break
old enough
offices,
that it may not be USB.
Right. So you can set it. You can just log. You can join the channel, and then you'll log all the conversations that are in there, and you can read along. During
Sync
the podcast, yeah.
I used
to actually capture all the text for the IRC chats and post them online for all the channel activity. I would just post the log as a look what he
one.
Got. He said, "Well, we'll see."
Score? No, this is going to work.
This is going to work. All right, so ladies and gentlemen, Barrett has found a very old school Mac mouse that was in the other room. It's one of those clear
body.
Oh, we have an LED lit up.
Look at that.
Yeah,
is it one of the circular ones?
No, it's one of these.
Yeah. I was thinking it was one of the, like, the hockey puck ones.
Does it work?
It works.
Does it really? I didn't
see we'll
see
if I work next week after touching this for a couple hours. But I
think
we
have some wipes in this studio.
Watch out for the
sure
dog.
Flicked has some anti-Ebola suits in his bag.
You can rub some Purell over it.
All right, so... Yeah, so IRC, website. Phone number is 713-526-5738 if you want to be on the air with us tonight.
And you want to be on topic.
And you want to be on topic. If you have something to contribute to the conversation, we invite you to call in a little bit later on as we discuss various topics, the bulk of which will be presented to us in the Technology Bites Info Shop. We've got Peter Hughes live in the studio. That's why everything just seems to be going so much better than it usually
is. It's always a better show when Pete's
here. Not here. In case he's listening on his way to his crawfish boil.
Well, you know.
Or whatever he's doing.
Whatever he's doing. Whatever Ars Technica nonsense he's involved
he's
in.
Been sent off.
Did you ever find the emails? Did you ever find the missing email?
No, and I use IMAP on Gmail, so it's kind of...
That's weird.
I don't know.
All right.
I'll...
I could. Are you covering the? Let's see.
Maybe it's in your spam folder.
It's weird because he replied to your weekly email where you know send us the update on the show prep, and he replied to all on that, and he said, "Heads up that I might not be making it tonight, but I know more about. I will know more within the next 30 minutes. The feature story we had going live tomorrow morning just ran into a major snafu." So I might have to...
We may have to create a story.
Yeah, he said crap out a story. So that's
a little insight into the world of technology journalism. It's after, you can get it from listening here.
It's after 8 p.m. The gloves are off.
All right, so...
Well, the other thing I guess it's coming up and that would apply to you podcast listeners and other station listeners is we're coming up on pledge drive for KPFT. No, don't go rushing to change your channels. It's not yet.
Or to call us with a pledge.
Or, yeah, to call. But, yeah, so if you're listening to the podcast, we don't post the pledge shows as podcasts, and they obviously don't get broadcast in the other...
in the other markets.
In the other stations. But if you want to support this show, if you like it that much, you can go to kpft.org, and there's a place to pledge. And one of the things that happens, you know, this is sort of the quiet, silent, you know, we're not putting the arm on you. But if you know you're going to pledge anyway, you can do that at your leisure over the next week or so, and that helps us, that gets credited to our goal.
Yeah, it'd be cool to have some people to thank, like our listeners in Ithaca that I know. We're rebroadcasting Ithaca on Saturday mornings, and some people who listen to the podcast and so forth. If you wanted to go to kpft.org and make a pledge, just, you know, give us somebody cool to thank come fund drive. And every bit that we make between now and the start of the fundraiser will go as a credit towards our, you know, our overall goal for the 3 weeks that we're going to have to do that. So if you're inclined, it'd be awesome if you go to kpft.org and make a pledge, because that is coming up. We did have somebody go online and make a pledge kind of out of the blue. We do want to thank Philippa, or however you say Philippa, who made a pledge online for us just out of the blue, random. I got a notification from our subscription person, Robin, and she said that they made a donation via the website. So is it working, Barrett?
The mouse, so I thought it was the actual mouse. I unplugged the mouse, and I guess maybe I can disable the trackpad. But the mouse is just jumping around all on its own now. Like, it's possessed. It's unplugged. I thought it was the mouse was just kind of wonky, but no. And it's actually... Hey, now.
Sometimes the trackpad issues on Macs are from the battery swelling. And obviously, if you have an Air, if the battery swells, then it puts pressure on the back of the trackpad and can give you that kind of behavior. So Jay pushing down on it... is the kind of thing that might possibly stop it from
cause it to hemorrhage.
No, I think it's
or it'll pop that battery like a zit.
Lance the F foil.
Jay broke my Oki.
Put that on YouTube. Get your video camera out.
This could go viral. So
you're closer to your justification for a backlit keyboard.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to get one now. I was gonna try and take this with me out of the country just because, you know, a month on the road with a laptop. I don't want to do the brand new laptop and rain and the elements and what have you. I was hoping to take this, but this doesn't want to go. So we may have to rethink that whole plan.
Just take the bottom off and see what's going on.
We'll see if we can't disable the trackpad. Surely it's hardware. I bet that's got to be it.
Can you disable the trackpad on a MacBook Air?
I would really hope so.
I would bet it probably isn't something with the control panel, but I have a feeling if you went into the right libraries or whatever, that there'd be the place to tell it to
ignore. I'm Googling now.
Say, if only there were some show that could answer some technical questions.
There used to be a show like that.
All right, from the Apple menu, choose System Preferences. Oh, yeah, this is Mountain Lion and Snow Leopard. Apple menu system preferences. From the view menu, choose universal
the
access.
The irony of this is that, of course, how do you choose that? What device do you use to try and
Can't you hit the Apple key?
Well, no, the mouse, the broken trackpad is also throwing click events, so it's clicking around, too. It's launching stuff. I mean, it is. It's really, it's no good. See, it's, whoa, it's trying to restart
Maybe
itself.
Somebody's remote, is somebody remote desktop?
No.
Again?
It's trying to go to a porn
Don't
site.
Feels that way.
It's robot porn.
It's all those TPS reports. Oh, this is just silly now.
Well, say you can learn how to locate the ignore trackpad when mouse or wireless trackpad is present.
Ooh, maybe Steve Jobs has possessed your...
There you go.
So Barrett, like, for those listening at home, this is very entertaining here in the studio because Barrett's MacBook Air, the cursor is got a mind of its own and it's doing whatever it wants.
Somebody Instagram this.
This is more of a Vine.
More Vine.
Actually,
now
this might be a Periscope.
Jump up.
Make a sound.
Well, I don't have an article on it, so it wouldn't be in a later segment. So I'll mention it now. But there are rumors that the Apple Bluetooth keyboard may go to backlit keys. So at the very least, you could get one of those. And
are those wired or those wireless?
No, the Bluetooth.
The wireless, right?
The Bluetooth keyboard isn't backlit right now.
Yeah.
But the rumor is that they may be coming out with one because it had the controls that are used for the backlighting on the function keys.
So battery is really the question at that point. Then I'd be curious. I guess LED wouldn't have much draw. Yeah.
Yeah.
A few hundred milliamps.
And they last a long time on a battery. You know, on regular batteries. Of course, I got the Mobi, the like wireless charger battery thing for the Bluetooth keyboard, and the thing that's sad is that the batteries on that now are like reached the end of their recharge cycles, and so now when you put one in, they only last.
What's the next move?
Okay, so you got into the. Okay, you want to go to the view menu and choose universal access.
Dun, 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 dun.
You can type universal. It might work. No? They only go up to Snow Leopard on this, so it may not.
Yeah, I think it's calmed down a little bit. Well, now it's...
Well, while he does that, should we push the button and I'll do... Yeah. That'll buy 5 minutes for... some more.
I think if we go by the monkeys typing Shakespeare method of this, if we just let it run, it'll eventually turn the trackpad off. It's clicking enough stuff
randomly.
That's
an infinite number of random clicks.
Yeah, I love that when you think it's not reacting to what you're doing, and so you do a bunch of stuff, and then you usually, like, it takes one of your later actions and does one of them, and then goes right back, goes back to the beginning of
what
you started.
Get to the view menu, I think, is where you want to go.
Everything, or it won't do what you actually asked it to.
And then you're looking for universal access.
My other big favorite is, some of these web pages that load sort of dynamically, and then you go to click the link on a headline and the page jumps because some content loaded up above it. Facebook is bad about it for some people, and some sites that have the big ad that expands at the top and shoves everything down right when you're about to click the article you went there for, then you end up clicking into something that's like, and it never is like similar where you go, oh yeah, I was going to read that one anyway. No, it's always like 10 reasons why, you know, you should shave your legs or whatever with it that you don't have any interest in.
I think Barrett's having success.
I haven't been able to kill it, but what I did was I turned down the scroll speed really slow, so at least now it's manageable. When it runs, I can catch it.
All right, so tech support in the studio. Cool. All right, so let's do the Technology Bytes InfoShot thing. Take it away, InfoShot.
It's the Technology Bytes InfoShot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Well, you may be sitting at home doing your taxes, since midnight tonight would be the time to turn that in if you're going to be wait till the last, absolute last minute. Although, here's something. If you're not going to make it, or if you don't just don't have the money to pay, file for an extension. Here's a tip for you. That makes things a lot better than just not filing. You get penalties and stuff if you don't file. But if you do the extension thing, you can avoid.
You're still
a lot
liable
of
for the.
You're liable for the amount you
interest.
Owe and some of the interest, but you don't get the penalties for not filing that you get if you wait. But other thing, so taxes, of course, as I was just talking about. Every time around this time every year, Joseph Bankman, a professor of tax law at Stanford Law School and a longtime advocate of using technology to simplify tax filing, gets on the phone with reporters to explain what is wrong with how we do our taxes in the United States. Every year he says – this is from the personal tech blog on the New York Times. Every year he says pretty much the same thing. No other industrialized country asks its citizens to jump through as many hoops to calculate their taxes as ours. You know, everybody hates filling out their taxes pretty much. I mean, I nobody enjoys it. I believe, you know, I use like an online tax, you know, one of the companies that used to pay and do a digital or, you know, programmatic or whatever. And that makes it simpler, but it's never a pleasure. And in a lot of countries, you know what they do is the tax agency fills out the taxes for you and sends them to you. And if you agree with it, you sign it and you're done, which sounds like a very quick way to do your taxes. Or Bankman and a small group of tax experts have called on the government to create a tax preparation method that would reduce the time and cost of tax filing. They might not go as far as to do all of it unless you had a really simple one. But, you know, right now, today, everybody sends the government like W-2s and all those forms. And then after you file your taxes, the government matches the two sets of documents to make sure you didn't make a mistake. That you filed it all correctly. To Bankman, the double documentation doesn't make much sense. If the government's already collecting the financial data, why couldn't they just pre-calculate your tax return for you, or at least have a database where that's where you get your info? So they just tell you, here's what we have reported for your income this year, and then, you know, then you can go from there. Instead of this kind of two-step thing where they put you on the honor system and then they figure out if you made a mistake or a typo or whatever. You know, here's a good example. Imagine if your vehicle registration fee was done the same way, Mr. Bankman asked in a recent interview. Quote, imagine if the state said, go to your car, find your VIN number, and then look at this table that has different tax rates to find out how much you owe. If they did, people would probably need to hire an expert for that, too. The thing is, it's been met with much opposition. It's called return-free filing. It's been met with much opposition from several groups, including conservatives suspicious of the IRS. Although, what else would they know about you that they don't know now if they filled out your tax return for you? I'll digress politically a little bit here. I think they want you to hate filing taxes because that is a big source of support for them is hating taxes. If it was easy, they think that people wouldn't mind so much and they wouldn't be able to capitalize on those people's rage. ProPublica has reported, though, some of the most intense opposition has come from Intuit, which has spent millions of dollars lobbying to oppose methods for the IRS to create a tax filing system that might free us from having to use software from companies like Intuit. In a statement, the chief tax officer and a former IRS official, David Williams is the chief tax officer at Intuit, said the company opposed return-free filing because the plan, quote, minimizes the taxpayer's voice and control over the tax process by reducing their role in filing their taxes and getting their own money back. Now, of course, everybody that has the return-free filing plan, if you didn't like what your return looked like or you thought that you had more things to deduct or any of that stuff, you could still fill out your taxes the old way and, you know, have your accountants do all the stuff and all that. The thing is, I think most people would probably just accept what they got and finish and, you know, just sign it and be done. So at the very minimum, though, and here's the thing that they're, you know, they could do this in little steps. Just imagine, though, if when you went to your tax preparation software, if it could just talk to a database at the IRS and retrieve that information, the information for you, like your W-2s.
Well, you can,
and other forms
you can
that you
get
to
your
file
W-2s
already.
Online in
but
some
that
regard.
Depends on your
company's,
business that
right,
you work
right.
for. And that still goes to the IRS. They all go to the IRS. So you could get all that stuff in one shot instead of relying on whether or not your employer.
Well, it almost seems like they want you to make a mistake. You know, that's the whole thing. It's like this isn't the purpose of this isn't to learn how to pay taxes. It's to pay your taxes. So it's kind of like the teacher, you know, giving a pop quiz when they've got the answer key and they're going to grade the test anyway. Just give us the answers, you know?
Right.
And we'll
right.
show up for class. We'll give you the answers, and all will be done.
So, you know, just the thing is, follow the money and think about what this stuff means. You know, I think it is unfortunate that a company will spend millions of dollars to lobby to oppose us having an easier time filing our taxes. Although, let's see, groups that call for lower taxes, like Grover Norquist's Americans for Tax Reform, says it is, quote, a conflict of interest, unquote, for the government to both collect taxes and calculate how much people owe. But if you can fill out, if you get the chance to, you know, well, and under that one, it's a conflict of interest when you get your property tax bill then, right?
Yeah. I like just this is the suggested thing. Like they put a little dot. If you pay this, we will not audit you. We won't come after you. This is what we think you owe. And I like that. And then don't make it a big deal to opt out. If you want, it's like doing the, you know, the easy form
right.
versus going through and itemizing. And the people that want to do
yeah,
that, the people that
standard deduction
yeah,
versus
all,
itemizing every single
all the rich
deduction.
Guys that want to get away with paying 15% overall, they can go get their attorney. You know, they can go get whoever they want to and still get into those, you know, very very ultra low tax things. And I'll just, you know, sign off on my way too high percentage.
So. And then the funny thing about this that I'll just note on the side is scrolling through the blog, it has some ads. And the ads are for software that helps you do your taxes. Tailored advertising based on the subject of the article. Isn't that great? And then, so speaking of, you know, government and IT, this one's a little bit more, you know, so if the IRS did have software to maybe do that, you know, to do the pre-filing or free filing free tax thing, would that program run like a lot of the ones that you read articles about, like the FBI trying to have its new evidence management system that it spent millions of dollars on and scrapped, or its case management system? If you look that Google that one, they have tried to build one. I believe they've done it two or three times since the 90s. And they've never been able to get it finished. The money got spent, but the software never worked.
Maybe they contract it to Intuit, and everybody's happy.
Yeah, they want the criminals to have the flexibility to file their own reports. This one's interesting. You know, when companies spend money on new technology, most studies say they get a decent return on that investment. The same seldom seems to be the case when it comes to state spending on IT, with a huge number of high-profile projects failing to deliver anything like the expected returns, or doing so having cost much more and come in long after they were expected to be delivered. Is that the reality or not? Well, a recent paper set out to explore the issue in more detail and found that the perception is actually unfair, with each dollar spent on IT projects yielding $3.50 in savings. A study found that investments in technology are generally making government departments more productive, efficient, and transparent, all of which generally reduces the costs. You know, it is the thing is, they said that it's difficult to measure, you know, accurately measure IT stuff with government spending because, you know, various technological advancements could actually expand what they need, you know, what the services do. This study looked at the impact of IT on state budgets and attempted to quantify the results using data from the CIOs of each state. And the reason they did that is because each state has to kind of do the same tasks, and so then you've got a basis for comparison to see what the cost would be. So I think that's cool. Every time using real numbers and studying it and having something that you can see what the results are works a lot better than using three news stories that got big coverage because they had some kind of fun angle that, that somebody in the media liked. You know, it's kind of the man bites dog thing. You know, all the projects that work, they're not going to talk about, but the ones that fail are going to get covered. So apparently, according to this study, until we see something different, it sounds like there is a return, and that you know, as you would expect, automation generally leads to improvements in service and lower costs. In other interesting news, 5 years ago, the European Union began investigating whether Google violated the antitrust laws of the European Union. And it has finally brought charges against the company, as well as opening a new investigation into the Android operating system. On Wednesday, the EU's executive branch, the European Commission, announced it had served the company with a formal complaint known as a Statement of Objections. If Google is ultimately found guilty of violating the law, the EU could reportedly level fines as large as $6.4 billion, roughly 10% of Google's operating revenue. The issue, what they're saying, is that the company uses its position as the dominant search engine company to muscle out competition from specialized search services, specifically comparison shopping sites, by prioritizing its own Google Shopping search results. European shopping search company Foundum filed a lawsuit against Google in 2010 and triggered the investigation. Although it's dragged on for years, new European Competition Commissioner Margreth Vestager seems determined to bring it to an end. The tough part with this one is this a Europe protecting its own thing, or is there really monopolistic behavior? The Android investigation is interesting. Although the operating system is open source, meaning that any manufacturer can install it on phones and tablets they sell, many core applications, including the Google Play Store, are proprietary. Manufacturers must enter into special agreements with Google to include these proprietary apps. The investigation will attempt to determine whether Google is using its position to discourage the inclusion of rival applications on Android-based phones. You know, anybody who's bought a skinned Android phone knows that I think that one is BS. If you can screw the operating system, if you can change the operating system so much that it's screwed up, then I don't think Google has. I think the Google, you can investigate them for not having enough control over Android, but investigating for having too much. Anyways, Google saw this coming. On Tuesday, Recode published what it says is a leaked internal memo from Google that acknowledged the EU's move and asked employees not to comment either internally or externally. So, you know, the idea that Google prioritizes stuff from people that pay them in their search results, is that surprising? I don't quite, you know, it's like when you pick up a circular for any store. Does the, you know, the stuff that gets on the front page of the circular is usually because somebody paid Walmart or Target?
Now, net neutrality doesn't mean that they can't regulate search, right?
So, you know, I don't know. I don't know that that's anti-competitive. If Google offers shopping results and somebody else has a shopping result search engine, just saying that Google's successful means that they're monopolistic or anti-competitive against the other guy. It's sort of like, why aren't people going to the other service? So we'll see. The Federal Trade Commission didn't see this the same way as the EU. Earlier this year, the Wall Street Journal obtained a report by the FTC's Bureau of Competition recommending that the agency bring a lawsuit against Google for unfair practices. The document was apparently released to the paper by mistake. It lodged several complaints against Google, such as its practice of displaying content from sites such as Yelp and Amazon on its own competing services. When competitors asked Google to stop taking their content, it threatened to remove them from its search engine, the journal reported. Okay, that's anti-competitive behavior. That's, oh, you got a nice site there. It'd be a shame if something were to happen about finding it on here. The paper also reported that staffers concluded that Google demoted or refused to display links to certain specialized search services, but recommended against an antitrust suit because Google had adequate pro-consumer justifications for its actions. And in a footnote, the staffers wrote that although Google had at one point sought to demote search results for all comparison shopping sites, the company had since tweaked its algorithm based on negative feedback from testers. So, you know, we'll have to see. You know, obviously the EU is more aggressive with the tech industry in general. Google is an American company. The EU's parliament passed a resolution last year recommending that Google's search engine be unbundled from the rest of its business. Although they don't have the authority to force Google to do that, but it does show how different the climate is with technology companies in Europe. There's also, you know, you may have heard, you know, the laws in Europe, their privacy laws are much more strict than here, including the so-called right to be forgotten law, where it has to remove outdated search results that might unfairly damage individual reputations.
Cookie notifications.
Yeah.
If you go to EU sites, you'll notice that. They have to let you know.
There's six European countries are investigating Facebook's privacy practices, such as how it uses like buttons to track browsing habits. Uber is banned in many European cities. So, you know, we'll keep an eye on this story as it goes along. It's one of those – it's not as clear as some of the other stories where somebody's got a monopoly and you can spot some clear things that they're doing that show that something's amiss. But, you know, at the very least, we'll – like I said, we'll watch this one and the Android one, which I think is farcical, frankly. But so there's that. On the hacking front, this one is – I'm going to start at the beginning before I even say what the headline is so that people don't get over – this is theoretical and it's more of a look ahead and understand it, not a, oh my gosh, run around in circles and scream. In-flight Wi-Fi, you know, when you fly on, you may have been on a flight – of late and heard that sound. You may have heard that sound because you were using Wi-Fi on your flight. Apparently airplanes with in-flight Wi-Fi are vulnerable to hacks by passengers or could be targeted by a quote malicious attacker unquote on the ground. This is a report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office describing potential dangers in a new report for the FAA titled FAA needs a more comprehensive approach to address cybersecurity as agency transitions to next gen. Which it's not just title only. You don't need to read anything else. What the study explained that IP networks of all kinds left flights open to cyber attacks, whether that's in-flight wireless entertainment systems, internet-based cockpit communications, or the new next-generation air transportation system due to be implemented by 2025. One of the things I heard in an NPR report on this is the network that modern planes, the latest planes like the new Airbus and the Boeing, the Dreamliner, they use the same network for their flight, their entertainment system, as they do for their avionics.
It's a lot like the OBDC stuff in cars, where you, instead of, you know, you lose so much weight by not having to run, you know, 10 sets of wires.
Right.
They're running a lot of the networking over the same things. They're doing virtual networking, and that never doesn't really go well. There was actually a talk at last year's Black Hat where, and I forget what his name is, Santa Marta, I think he worked for IOActive, and he demonstrated how he could, and this was just on passenger jets, jump through like air gap systems, for instance. I think he went in through the Wi-Fi and the in cabin entertainment system and was able to access the satellite communication systems.
Ooh,
yeah.
So, well, apparently Reuters the GAO was paying attention. So usually that kind of thing is, you know, something bad happens and then somebody says, oh, yeah, remember there was a Black Hat presentation on that five years ago.
And the other big issue, which is kind of hidden in the paper, is that they don't really have any good way of – so, for instance, they've got service, you know, maintenance life cycles. And they can say, okay, when this engine has 10,000 hours on it, you have to do this, and this. And if it doesn't, they've got systems in place to make sure that those engines don't get into the air. With the software systems, they have no such control. So if something did come out, if they said, hey, there's a critical vulnerability in this software, there's no system in place right now that would actually ground planes or even track what versions of software they have in the same way that they do with all the other maintenance cycles, to where, you know, there's, so if something hit like 4 hours,
had been upgraded.
Yeah, exactly. You wouldn't know. Or if something came out and it was, you know, very, very important, and, you know, 2 weeks went by and you wouldn't know who had upgraded and who wouldn't, and you wouldn't have the ability, at least from the FAA's perspective, to ground planes based on those software updates. And that, to me, is a really big deal. Like some guy jumping through the entertainment system and maybe pinging something, whatever. I mean, eventually it'll happen, but once that gets out, you've got to have an ability to update that and protect against that, and that's the big piece that's missing right now.
Well, and if you're going to have it run, if the avionics and the entertainment are going to run on the same network, it seems to me that you should have that the communication between, for instance, the controls in the cockpit and, oh, say, the engine management controls, that should be. And if you're not going to have it on its own wires, which seems to be the safest way, or its own fiber optic or network or whatever, if you're not going to do that, then at least you should have heavy duty. It's all right there, encryption. You know, I mean, in other words, you've got, you're not talking about having to put it across the open internet, but you can, and you should be able to encrypt and decrypt on the local network quickly enough, I would think, that it wouldn't hamper operations. This seems to me to be sort of security through obscurity, like why they won't tell you how the stuff works on your car, and that means that some kid can, like, you know, reprogram your car when you're just by being near it. Or there's been the stories that they don't know what they're doing, but they're getting into cars thing. There was one of those stories where the police don't want to say what they think the people are doing, but they're stealing cars with it. And so it's like, well, you know, how about, why don't you fess up? Right. They just know they don't want a lot of people upset about.
So it's been a big week in hacking, not to derail the new stuff, but no, did you see the TSA stuff that's been going on? And that wasn't so much a hacking job, but more or less a TSA agent was arrested because he had a way to put him in a position to grope other male passengers when he thought a certain male passenger was attractive. He did that by doing some kind of notification to one of the other screeners. The other screeners would flip the software. If it was a man entering, it would say it was a woman, and it would find, biological material where there shouldn't be biological material on a woman.
It would
tag them for a pat down.
A man would go through the scanner and they have it set to the man setting, so his genitals would not trigger the alarm. But if you said it was a woman and there was a package in the groinal area, then it's like, oh, they're carrying something. So this guy would get to do a pat down on a male.
Happened in Denver, yeah. But he was a little bit of a, it was a hack. He was working the system to get things, you know, done. Not, that's a horrible thing to get things to, take it from there. But, yeah.
You'd think
hack the package.
Yeah, that's one of those things. Yeah, he was hacking the package where everything was, he was working within the system. They were working, you know, the software. It wasn't anything that was, you know, broken necessarily in the system, but it's how they implemented the system, and it's a huge big weakness, you know.
I'm amazed they caught him.
Yeah, no, I think he bragged.
I think people might have complained.
Well, there would be that, too. Oh, and then they started, if they follow the complaints back, then it's like, well, they were checking you because of,
the part of the story I'd heard, they had bragged, and usually that's how most hackery things get taken down. You go tell somebody, and then that person tells somebody, and then the next thing you know.
They posted it on TSAgroping.com, right, on their big, on their 4chan.
Now, this one's a little bit better, this was the Barrett time that I didn't get to finish. The winner prison dinner one, did you hear about this?
No.
So this is actually kind of cool, and this was just the last week. So a man, and I don't know what state it was, he actually went in and manipulated the lottery. So there is a sealed room where there's a computer that picks the lottery numbers. It's, you know, ensconced in glass. It's got cameras. It's locked. And more or less, he went in there and somehow he manipulated the security camera to where instead of taking a continuous feed, it only took a picture every 60 seconds. So just still frames like that. So he got in there. And then he took this out of the NSA playbook. He changed the salt that influences the pseudo-random number generator to where he could predict the numbers that would come out, the lottery numbers. So he went, and this is where it all fell down. He just should have gone and paid someone to buy a ticket, but he went somewhere else, bought a ticket himself, which was caught on video. And again, he works for the thing, and the number came up. It worked. But they put everything together.
And then once they followed it back, yeah, I believe the people who could control the frame rate on the security cameras, there's only five. And the other four
all said that it wasn't them.
They all had clear alibis and hadn't done it. And he didn't say anything.
But not a direct attack, and not one of those attacks where you go in and you say, like, okay, the number will be 24, this, this, this. He attacked at a much lower level, and what it did was it eroded, you know, what you would think would be random number generation, which plays a huge hand in cryptography, and it's pretty much, you know, what the NSA is suspected of having done to a lot of our, you know, low-level encryption algorithms and stuff that are out there. The ones that are actually out there in the wild working, coding in binary, you know, binary form.
Yes. So, and the thing is, it's like it almost is like reading the circumstances where that computer was is like Mission Impossible. It was set up where there should, by their rules, were that there should be two people in the room at a time. And
it's like Superman 3 with the two keys with Richard Pryor, and yeah. You know, it seemed like that. It did, you know.
And so, but he seemed to think he had a way around it.
And then one last cheating one. The singing the blues in Georgia. Did you hear about the, I think he was like 24, 26 years old, the Georgian chess, and this is Georgia, Baltic States, the chess champion who got busted using his iPhone to win tournaments. And I think he's like number one ranked in Hungary. He was playing his opponent, and every single match, so as soon as his opponent would, you know, make a play, he would have to go tinkle. He'd have to run off to the bathroom. And his opponent noticed this and said something, so they sent officials into the bathroom stall. He was always going to the same stall, too. They sent officials into the stall, and wrapped up in some toilet paper stuck behind the toilet was an iPhone, which he claimed was not his. But when compared to the chess logs of play-by-play, that phone was tracking that game, and it was also logged into one of his social media accounts. So a little bit red-handed, but now a lot of people have come out and said, hey, this is actually rampant, and it, you know, probably like, you know, 20%, 30% of the players out there are cheating, and cell phones made it extremely easy.
Oh,
that's kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they asked why you don't make people – I heard a report on this, and they said that they didn't want to make you have to, like, take off your shoes and go through a detector to go play chess, that it might reduce interest.
I think battle chess, you know,
although,
like,
why would
talk
you,
some trash?
Why would you go cheat? That would be, you really know that you're not that level.
Well, I mean, you know.
Having to go to use an iPhone to play.
Chess champions do get the ladies. Okay, that might not have been why.
Ask Bobby Fischer about that one. Well, but so
he's actually not a nice person. Not that we should get off into that, but I've been reading a lot of stuff about Bobby Fischer lately.
Yeah, he was an odd duck,
or rather, what he's been saying lately. He's been getting on the internet with social media, and he just kind of hates everybody.
So on the airplane one, the where the threats happen. There's two forms that they think that the threat would come, it says the GAO. First is intrusion into avionics systems by passengers using in-flight Wi-Fi. I mean, on the plus side, at least they have to be on the plane to do it, because the cockpit avionics use the same networking platform and physical wiring and router as the entertainment system. The second related threat comes from the wider internet. The report said FAA officials and experts were concerned that since aircraft use IP networks like any other communications hub, that potentially provides a route into its systems for an attacker who is, for instance, able to install malware on passengers' devices without their knowledge. You know, I would put under the least of my worries if I'm in a plane and somebody's hacked through the firewall from the larger internet into my plane. But I could see where that they may want to. Some of this you'd think that they would. I would think you put more layers in. First of all, is like if you're going to have your plane having Wi-Fi, I would think you maybe proxy that through somewhere so that you can filter what's going in and out and more closely. But. You know, there so far, I want to circle back. So far, there has been no known real-world instances in which a plane has been hacked either from within or outside. But it has been demonstrated, as Barrett said. And so the plus side of this is there's enough notice of it that there's an article and there's a report from the government. So that should hopefully that will help with the them having a solution. But it seems to me you should design the solution in as you build that's one where security should be at the beginning, not,
yeah.
Oh, hey, let's, how do we tack that onto this plane while it's already in flight?
That's gotten really hard to do, though. I mean, I guess this last year, there have been like a number of devices that have come out and they said, like, hey, we're secure, like the Anonbox or Anonabox, the secure router. And then they had like the Black Phone that came out and all these devices that came out and promised, like, this is the ultimate secure device. They were all broken almost before they even, actually, the Anonabox was broken into and had exploits discovered before it actually shipped. They had to do a recall. So, yeah, to me, like, if you're going to have a super, if you're going to call something like this is built with security in mind or security designed, it has to be a beyond reproach. Like, there has to be no possible way. And I think that's where avionics need to go. But as long as you're using off-the-shelf TCP/IP networking, I don't think we're going to get that.
Yeah, you would think that you'd come up with some kind of alternate networking that would be, because first off, at least then you can't, like, I don't know, control the plane from your browser kind of thing. Yeah, you know, I'm sure that's an exaggeration. But, you know, it seems like getting it to where changing the language, you know, changing the underlying network protocol, it's a lot easier to trace if somebody had to use a different protocol. First of all, it's a lot easier to block and it's a lot easier to trace what's going on if you're not using the same, you know, if you're not making the IP address of the flaps on your plane part of the same network as, you know, everybody's porn sites and cat pictures and all those other things.
Welcome to the Internet of Things.
So, yeah. So very, very, you know, very odd to find out. It's one of those where, you know, who can you trust anymore for doing things in a secure way? Finally, you know, even though it's 10 to, we've put a lot of other discussion in, so it made the news go a little longer. If you work in IT security and somebody in your company gets a phishing email, you know, just the usual kind of broad-based, not spear phishing, just, you know, one of those, your credit card's been declined or your credit's been used, click here to read the report. You have a minute and 20 seconds to save your company from being hacked. That's not a drill. That's the median time it takes for an employee to open a phishing email. Setting in motion a race to prevent data from leaking. That's according to the new Verizon Breach Investigations report, which was due to be released tomorrow, but they had a preview for reporters today. So, you know, they asked, how long do you have until the first message in the campaign is clicked? And they said that usually it takes within a couple of minutes. With users taking the bait this quickly, the hard reality is you don't have time on your side when it comes to detecting and reacting to phishing events. Verizon noted that 23% of recipients open phishing messages, but simply opening an email won't necessarily install malware on a machine. More dangerous are the 11% who go so far as to click on malicious attachments. There's a lesson for all of you at home on this, not just people in the corporate world, although in the corporate world too. Don't, you know, opening the phishing message, I guess they don't really define what they mean by opening it. Looking at it, I don't know. It's hard to hold that against somebody because most people, you know, at the office, I do inbox zero. I'm going to look at all of them. If it means clicking on a link in it or doing some action after that, I don't do that. But lots of people are going to look at it. This is the 8th year of Verizon's report. They analyzed breach intelligence and data from multiple sources, including their forensics customers and customers of FireEye, which is the firm that investigated the recent hack at Sony. It also examines data from cases investigated by law enforcement and government. This year, Verizon analyzed data involving nearly 80,000 breaches contributed by 70 different organizations. So, you know, again, once there's a breach, they said within minutes the data was starting to be siphoned out. And 37% of the breaches examined, defenders were able to contain the attack within a few hours. And in an additional 30% of the cases, they were able to contain the adversary within days. Of course, just think about how much data per second can be funneled out. You know, and when you go to days with that, when you're talking about, talking about the speed of networks nowadays, that is a heck of a lot of data. So, when you get an email if you get an email from your bank or from somebody if it's an email where it's like, oh my gosh, I better click on this immediately, that's the moment to stop and think for a second before you click it, especially at work. If it's business related, you may want to think about calling whoever it is. If it's from your boss, and it's not something you were expecting, but if it's about your bank or some of that stuff, and you get it at work, first off, make sure that does your bank have your work email address? Because what happens for a lot of people is they don't think about it. When the email comes in and says, oh, there's been a report of malicious activity on your bank account, they don't go, oh, which email address did this come to? They go, oh, my God, I've got to take care of this. And they click the link, click here for details or whatever. So you need to kind of fine-tune your eye towards if there's anything at all suspicious about what you've received. If it's got a call to action that you wouldn't normally expect, or it seems like something where there's just you shouldn't even it's an emergency, you really need to click this right now. Stop and take a breath, look at who it's from, and by that I don't mean just look at the name, look at the email address that's associated with that name and make sure it's real. And frankly, if you have any doubts, like I said, pick up the phone and call the person that supposedly sent it if it's at work, because that you can't get hacked. But when you start clicking stuff, then you got a whole different picture going on, and you don't want to be the one when they trace it all back that was the guy who opened the door to the malicious hackers from Amazon.
A lot of the large profile break-ins recently have not been because someone's hacking through these firewalls and doing these quote unquote hacks. It's mostly phishing. It's getting emails inside, getting people to click on stuff, getting stuff installed that way. The weak link is the person, not the firewall or the server or the somebody piece of software.
Nobody comes in and blows up the door to the safe. Not when they can get the bankers inside to hand the money out through the side door,
Well, there's a couple of things you could do when you get an email. You should always hover over any of the links in the mail, because what they'll do is they'll put a link that might say irs.gov, but you hover over it and it shows you where it's actually linking to, and it's some gobbledygook,
irs.ga.
Yeah, and if it's not simple, because some of them will have, blah, 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 dot irs.gov, dot bananas.com, you've got to read the whole thing. If it's from your real bank or if it's from the IRS, it's going to be a nice short little URL that you can read and understand. If it's not, then think twice.
The last part, before the .com or the .net, before the .dot, that three-letter part, that's what actually matters. You can stack whatever you want to up ahead of it, and that's called a senium or a canonical name. It's the last part that matters. You can do ibm.com, .gov, .whatever, .hacker.com, and it's all going to be hacker.com.
Right. All right, well, that music tells us it's time for us to take a short break, so we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
And he's Groove House.
Oh, hello.
He's Groove House. Potted down mic.
Oh, boy. What?
No, the mic wasn't potted down. He didn't have his headphones on.
No. Uh-oh. He was looking at his phone.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be right back.
Groove House.
KPFT's new morning lineup gives you an enlightened start to your day. Starting at 5, we begin your morning with The Attitude. Host Arnie Arneson brings you the latest news and analysis mixed in with humor and commentary. At 6, internationally renowned talk show host Tom Hartman brings conversation, debate, and more to get you warmed up for the day. At 7, it's time for Democracy Now! And award-winning journalist Amy Goodman's interviews and on-the-ground reports from hotspots around the globe. At 8, KPFT's informed morning program, Open Journal, brings you news and culture from our area. And at 9, the best and brightest voices, including Professor Richard Wolf, Dr. Michio Kaku, sports journalist Dave Zirin, and more help you understand the day's news. You can view our complete program schedule at kpft.org. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
KPFT is seeking prospective volunteers to help in our music library. Our music library is a massive resource for our DJs and listeners. Volunteers will be assigned a number of different tasks, from refiling CDs to converting music for inclusion into the upgrade of our music library focused on digital. We're also looking for people who can spot up-and-coming bands to feature on our HD3 music stream. Successful volunteers will be team players who work well with others, have the ability to alphabetize, and can manage multiple tasks. Shifts happen weekdays, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. This is an unpaid volunteer gig, but it is one of the most fun times ever for anyone into music, music discovery, and turning others on to outstanding music. Interested? Drop an email to music@kpft.org with the subject line Music Volunteer. We'll take it from there. This is 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston, kpft.org worldwide.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. Now back to Technology Bites.
And
we're joining your show already in progress.
So, you know, for those of you listening here in Houston, I want to let you know that there is no Think Wing coming on after this show. So we're going to be playing Michio Kaku Explorations, which is like the olden days. So awesome. Some more science.
Science! We can't go round up some vegans off the street and just... Maybe lock them in the control booth.
Don't
stir some grains in
there. Please don't stir up the vegans.
But that's
tell
even going
want
further
them for
back.
Guests on Chicken Wing Radio.
Poke them with a Slim Jim.
You want them on the Cased Meat Show.
You're going to get food thrown at you.
The spam program.
All right, so welcome back to Technology Bites. There's no Barrett time. Did you want to cover anything?
We should say happy birthday to Moore's 50th, though, I think.
Moore's Law?
Yeah. 50
Roger Moore?
50 years.
Every year he gets 100% better.
Yeah, I was about to say, he's going to turn.
Right, so Moore's Law is the law of...
Bond, James Bond.
Technology expansion.
Yeah, basically what, the capability doubles and the price...
Not so much, yeah.
His original statement was just about the number of transistors, right? It was like every 18 months it doubles.
Yeah, this is why I actually have stuff written down, but it's jumpy. So yeah, so 1965, pretty much. Well, yeah, the mouse, I'm still having mouse issues a little bit. So in 1965, the year in which the number of components on a microchip doubled, Gordon Moore predicted that certainly, this is his words, certainly over the short term, this rate can be expected to continue. So in 1975, he revised the rate to 2 years, the doubling rate to 2 years. Later, it settled down to about 18 months, or an exponential growth rate of about 46%. So this is Moore's Law. That's what Moore's Law is. So the arguments that a lot of people are saying like, hey, it's turned 50, but it's not going to see 60. It's slowing down, and that it was never like a mathematical law. It was, if anything, it was almost more of a sociological kind of law. That actually, it's kind of been damaging in some ways, too. This is, if you go to IEEE, yeah. They've got, I think, maybe like 6 or 7 different essays on Moore's Law. And one of the ones, I think there were two that kind of stood out. One of the ones that I thought was kind of cool was the damaging effects. And that's just because some people that kind of get their heads around a simple construct, and I'm guilty of this too, and they say like, okay, technology doubles every 18 months. So you look at that, and it's true with transistors, and maybe it's true with photovoltaics, and it's true with a couple of other things, but it's not true with grain production. It's not true with like flying cars. It's not right. True with really anything else.
What about batteries?
Yeah, and well, some,
not
so yeah, yeah,
all.
No, not true at all.
Not
so
yet, no.
And if you look at it, and if you look at like economic growth, you know, like for instance, like wheat production has grown at like 1.8% per annum for forever. I mean, that's about as much as we can get, and we can't get other industries to catch up with this exponential rate of growth. So what's going to eventually happen is it's going to die, and there people are saying, hey, we might get one more little bump pretty soon, but that's about it. And the cool thing is, I think there was a week or two ago when we were talking about like, you know, antique laptops and antique, you know, like the Apple Watch. Maybe we can revisit that here in a bit since that just came out. But the idea of, you know, having a vintage computer that is anything more than just, you know, something you sit on the shelf and go, oh, it's a vintage computer, that might go away. Once we run out of the computing power, you max that out, you may have, like, you know, the laptop may stop and I'm going to say a laptop, but the argument is a laptop may stop progressing to the point where it arrives where it needs to be, and it could be like a watch or, you know, something like that that you hand down. It becomes a tool, and maybe there's some other kind of software, something like that. So you can get, you know, heirloom laptops, which is kind of neat.
Because they are getting down to, yeah, it sounds like Intel, you know, they're getting down to the, there's only so many nanometers of they can get down to on circuits.
Yeah, so that's kind of the dark side.
Before an electron, like, bends the pathway.
Yeah,
because they're getting to the point now, the size is so small that the actually electrons flowing down the path actually deform the pathway. Mm-hmm. And if they get too small, it'll actually bend and break the pathways that they're traveling on.
Now, so it's going to be like one of those, what was that, that thing you could attach to your hose that caused it to go
the
all...
The water wiggle?
The water wiggle. It'd be the data wiggle. The data will transform the pathways and it'll just...
Well,
that's like your mouse. That was like a techno wiggle.
Maybe the MacBook, the new MacBook... is more of an example of the future than one might think. You know, essentially, if you want to take the like worst description of the MacBook, and because it fits in here, that's why I'm going to use it. You know, it's got the horsepower of a 2011 MacBook Air, but the other side of it is it's got that huge screen that it's driving, and its battery life is pretty close to the same. So what you're doing is you're getting a lot more horsepower for the amount of power you put into it, which is that's a positive. So at some point, it's going to get to be how creatively they manage those mm-hmm. types of things, so that like getting more energy efficiency out of it and some of that, as opposed to raw horsepower.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the upside of it too, is that when Moore's Law finally stalls out, I think a lot of people are predicting that another round of innovation is going to come about, because we can't get this horse to go any further this way, so we're going to have to start coming up with creative ways to rearrange things that we already have. So that'll be kind of neat, and that's where, you know, Internet of Things keeps coming into play, and just all these different, you know, instead of, you know, being able to build things and make things faster, like, let's start taking a look at what we can do with the things that we have.
Well, and some stuff is like, you know, it's the old, you know, they stopped it because the processors got too much faster, but what was the joke for a large chunk of Technology Byte's life was the whole making clusters, you know, putting more processors on the job instead of, you know, bumping up the individual ones. And that was I think that kind of came at a sort of a flat spot where it didn't feel like the speeds were going up that quick. And so people started having, you know, multiple processors in the same box and so on. Then they managed to cram them all onto one die and make multiple processors, multiple cores in one. So I think at some point they'll go back to the, like, dividing up the work more and having more processors handling the...
There was one other essay that was kind of scary too, and this kind of, especially us being in Houston, it's kind of odd. So they looked at, you know, drilling technology, and this is where we've gotten ourselves into trouble. So, it's arguable, and this also gets a little bit political too, I suppose. It's arguable that, you know, we got through the Industrial Revolution, especially, you know, us and China and Russia and Europe, on fossil fuels. And, you know, India's trying to do it. China's still kind of doing it. And we're kind of wagging our fingers saying, hey, don't do that because of, you know, that's not the point. The point is, though, that most of the Earth's oil, the easily gotten oil, is gone. We've gotten that. So if we ever had to reboot, like, as a civilization, so, like, let's say, you know, U.S. got wiped out, whatever, you know, people get wiped out and they've got to come back up, they will not have the benefit of that very, very rapid growth that we had during the Industrial Revolution, because the oil that they will need to get to fuel that is so far down, they need the technology that an Industrial Revolution provides to be able to reach the oil to fuel the Industrial Revolution. And that was, again, one of those dark sides to, you know, that the Moore's Law is, we, you know, and if you look at, you know, the huge geological scale and how long it took to produce all these fossil fuels, you know, we figured out the technology to extract very, very deeply down. You know, we're getting into fracking, we're getting into, you know, going into shale and getting oil out, that it's extremely fast. We've depleted, you know, we're depleting things very, very quickly. And that's a one-time thing.
Are you trying to pitch a TV series?
No. This, ooh. What if all the power went out? Hold on.
The cool thing, though, is that finally we seem to have hit that point where Moore's Law helps out on renewable stuff, though, where one of the things that it's, you know, there, it came up in some of the articles, you know, with gas prices low, then, of course, last time gas prices went down, what did we get? We got the SUV and the 500 horsepower Mustang kind of stuff coming out, where the difference is this time, the renewable power costs are continuing to drop, and they're getting down to where they, as time goes on, they continue to become more competitive, so that things like coal, at some point solar and wind, solar in particular is one that gets into the kind of electronics end of things, that it becomes sort of unbeatable because of the price keeps dropping. You know, the opposite on resource intensive things is the price starts out cheap and then it gets harder to dig more out. You know, the kind of cost and effort to do fracking takes a civilization that's got a certain amount of stuff to be able to do it, where the solar panels, the price on that continues to drop. Of course, I guess you have to have a certain
you'd have to be able to discover the solar panels and be able to work with the graphene and be able to work with all the different things. So you've got to have, you know, and again, I'm not saying it can't be done. The argument here is that it would not happen as rapidly at the same speeds that it did, because, you know, that horse of fossil fuels that we rode in here on isn't going to be around for the people that come after us.
Hopefully, one of the things that'll happen, you know, when people talk about climate change, one of the things that they say is an obstacle is, of course, the countries who are just ready to kind of take that ride up the hill to the big advancement roller coaster that America went on before, like India, you know, where they're poised to have, they've got a growing middle class, they want to have things like we have. We set the example as part of it, folks. You know, they want air conditioning and they want fast food restaurants and all the stuff we've got, all these, and a car, two or three cars per person, like we kind of have, if you look at the numbers.
But, and diabetes.
You know, yeah, obesity and
all the lovely trappings of modern civilization
that comes along with it. No, but you know what you hope is that at some point the price becomes compelling, where it's like, well, why would you bother to do? It's kind of like in Africa, where their cellular networks are very sophisticated, and what they do with them is very sophisticated, actually even compared to us, because they skipped over trying to run enough wire. Mm-hmm. To everybody's house. So now cell phones that's got currency and all kinds of things. So you hope that some of this will help some of these places that maybe weren't as resource blessed to jump in closer to the future without, you know. Yeah, I know this is a do as we say, not as we did, but, you know, some of the stuff we didn't know about until.
That's
kind of
like South Korea, right, and their network. Right, their network is way better than ours because they built it way later, and so they had a lot better technology to build their infrastructure with. Right, so their data speeds are pretty impressive compared to the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I just got an email, although it's – or not an email, a marketing thing. You know, where I live, it's still Time Warner. They didn't have to flip me over to Comcast like they did you guys here. But that said they were going to double the speed that you, or they were going to increase the speed from your account, and they did. I have an eye for marketing language. They said up to, you know, so if you have this kind of account, you could get up to thus and such a speed, which means they're not lying as long as it goes up. But mine said that it could go up to 300 megabits per second, and it's like, I'm sure that that's one of those, you know, that's where they say the car dealer, where it's like cars as low as $19.95 or whatever, $19.95. And it's like, yeah, there's going to be one and you're not going to want it.
It's a matchbox.
And this is the flip side, where the up to thing is, that means under the ultimate reality, you could,
in a perfect lab scenario.
Well, or
if your house was 1 foot from the.
I'll be snarky. No, if your house was on a network that Google was offering gigabit, then your service would go up to the 300 megabit at least, I think. But I don't know. Here's an invite for calls. You know, Barrett mentioned, you know, the Apple Watch has come out. You know, or they released it for the actually, was it ordered? Maybe we need to check. Is this pre-orders? Do people?
I thought you could pre-order and you could go look at them, but I'm not sure if they shipped them.
That you actually could have them to use. Let's see, Apple Watch's ship date.
Although I haven't really paid attention too closely because I'm not planning to get one.
The release date is April 24th.
Yeah.
So
a week from Friday.
Let's see. Yeah, so they have the pre-orders, which there's already been It sold more at launch through pre-orders than Android Wear watches did in all of 2014. New orders have been pushed back as far as July already.
So hold on, they've sold more than 15 watches so far. That's awesome.
I know that somebody like Moto 360 or whatever dropped its price with the release of with just the pre-order date of the Apple Watch. So I don't know. So nobody has them yet either. Geez. So, okay. Well, we'll wait.
Do you have a gut feeling on this? Do you think this is going to be like an iPod, or do you think this is going to be, I don't think it's going to fizzle out like the Android watches did, but do you think people are going to forget about this in a year? Do you think this is going to be a version one of a lot of really cool things to come?
Good question. I think this falls somewhere in the middle. It's not going to be like the iPod. The iPod, everybody was like, yeah, nobody's going to want it. They said all the same kinds of things they said about the Apple Watch, and then it was huge. I don't think this one has quite the... Well, first off, just the price is pretty stout. There was a survey of teenagers on what they want, what they're interested in, or they think they're going to be buying. And cell phones and iPhones are high up on their list. The watch, not so much, partly because it costs as much as a phone. So it's like if they're going to aspire to one thing, they kind of have to go to the phone first. And so it's dependent on that. So mm-hmm. You already have to be in the Apple ecosystem, which cuts out a large being really honest. I mean, yes, the iPhone's very successful in that, but Apple's main success is they make most of the money in the phone business. They don't sell the most units in the phone business. And so there's a lot of Android users out there who an Apple Watch does zip for. And so I think this is going to be sort of somewhere in the middle, and it's not being wishy-washy. I don't think it's going to be a flop. I think that as they offer new generations of it, that more people will go ahead and go in on it, but I don't think it's going to take off like the iPhone and the iPod and the iPad, unless they come up with something very different, in the future, the second or third gen of it.
I think these are worldwide numbers, but for fourth quarter 2014, Android made up 76% of the smartphone market, and iOS only made up 19.7%. So it's
kind of a that you have to have that for you got to have that base to use it. So that's a limiter on it. Do I see myself having one at some point? Probably not soon, though. I mean, I didn't pre-order, and I'm not going to, it would be one of those that has to combine with, like, having a good bit of disposable income and just being, having the opportunity and it's just available to get, which, in a sense, the first iPhone was kind of like that. I mean, there was the people who waited in line, but then you couldn't get one, and... I didn't buy the first gen iPhone. My first one was a 3GS, which that was the third phone, because the 3G was the second gen iPhone, just to keep it confusing. I guess when people start, whenever you get an Apple Watch, call our show, tell us what you think about it. But I didn't really think about it, and that's one of those where usually with Apple, the ship date might be a few weeks different than the announced date, but this is kind of sort of ridiculous for as long, the lag time. I mean, they pre-announced it in October, and then last month they had the announcement of the release of it, or they announced the pre-order date. And then the ship date is still more than a week away before the first person who isn't like media gets a phone.
I didn't realize this. Did you know that the watches are back ordered by up to 3 months?
Already?
Just about? Yeah, if you mentioned that, apologies, but I didn't quite realize.
I think one of the articles said that it's back to, it's pushed
all
back
the way to August. Yeah,
oh,
people are saying
August
now. Yeah.
So, the thing about it is that it shows a demand among people who want Apple Watches, but it's not like, for regular followers of the show, it's not like trying to get into Star Wars was.
The only thing I can think of is that Apple wanted to freeze the market. Like, maybe they thought something was going to come out that was going to steal market share, and so they
get it out there as soon as they
can. They basically wanted to make people wait it to freeze the market.
I think you get Apple, if they're wise, you can do this once, and they did it. Then they've done it now, and they shouldn't do it again. Microsoft got addicted to the kind of FUD, the sort of announce and freeze, and people stopped buying into it, and they, you know, they're sort
stopped,
of suffering for
they it. Stopped buying it altogether.
Yeah, they stopped buying it at XP. But you know, Apple's played that card once. I don't think they can do it again. They need to, you know, and it's not just a you know, it's not just a post Steve Jobs. You know, Steve Jobs wouldn't have, I don't think, would have done it this way on announcing it. But and so I think they, instead of, you know, with like the MacBook Air, there were things you could see where Apple was setting up. They bought up a lot of SSD capacity at high prices early on to you know, to set up for what they were going to do. But they didn't tell it. You know, they didn't announce it until he had something that he could bring out on stage in a manila envelope and show people. And I think they over, you know, in the technology world, you don't want to promise too soon, because something always comes up where you can't deliver on time. And I think Apple may have expected, and we'll watch for the stories and see if that comes out. I think Apple wanted to have more watches available to start with, and they're not getting the yields that they wanted.
Although
they
seem to have done that numerous times, where, you know, stuff wasn't there to meet demand.
But I think it's worse. I think this is more a product of I don't think the demand is higher. I think it's that Apple stretched. You know, they already, like, back in October, kind of put a stake in the ground and, oh yeah, you know, real soon, you know, first quarter next year kind of thing. And how did they get first quarter? Well, by having the event in March and then announcing another 6 weeks. So they bought themselves the extra 6 weeks. And then it sounds like the first few days, you know, the pre-orders did consumed what they had made, but which was, I think, a million watches. The thing is, though, there was when a new iPhone comes out, they ship way more than a million of them that first weekend. What was I'm trying to remember what the peak iPhone?
Well, they swapped out.
Was.
They were using Foxconn for a lot of the earlier builds, and I know that for the iWatch, they switched over to, I think it was Quanta, which is a direct competitor of Foxconn, but I don't think they're tooled for the production that Foxconn is.
The first weekend of iPhone sales, and this one is, I want to see the date. So it's on an Apple press release, and so I want to see one that has a date before I... Okay, September 22nd, 2014, in first weekend of sale, Apple sells 10 million iPhone 6s, you know, 6s and 6 pluses. The iPhone 5s and 5c, it sold 9 million devices in the first weekend. They sold over a million watches, but that's not close to the 10 million that they sold on the iPhone 6. And I think that's a product, part of it's a product of... Once people, you know, it sounded like, again, if you didn't get up at 2 in the morning.
It still seems pretty impressive that 1 out of 10 people with an iPhone 6.
Yeah, that is fairly insane. Here's the deal, too.
That's just in a weekend. That was the first weekend.
Right.
They've been selling iPhone 6s.
But I'm just saying, like, 1 in 10 people, as far as, like, the first week, or the first weekend, right? 10 million, 1 million. Like, the people that, like, went there to get it the first weekend, 10 million people went. The people who went to get this the first weekend, 1 million.
Do you know what anyone else want to take a guess on what the first opening weekend for 1 million sales was on what other Apple kit? iPhone, first generation, sold 1 million the opening weekend, as did the 3G in 2008, the year after. Both of them did 1 million. And then the 3GS also did 1 million in 2009. It wasn't until 2010 with the 4 they bumped up to 1.7 million. And then 4 million with the 4S, and it started growing from there.
So was it just a deal where they wanted to meet some kind of announcement timeline with no intention of actually delivering?
I think just that this is so complicated to make. I think the engineering.
Yeah, but they didn't. They should have known that it was going to take however long to produce enough units to actually sell.
There's also so many variants. Like how do they know what's going to be popular or which ones to make? Like.
Well, I think that Well,
like
some
when
of
you're
it though.
An iPhone 6,
obviously, they didn't make a half a million cases. Rose gold ones, unless they're just crazy.
I would think that the band and everything would be the easier part to make. I would, if anything, I would want to go out and go to, you know, like Swatch or partner with someone existing to do those, and then just let me, you know, handle the software and the hardware on the inside.
Although they don't, if you saw the
thing,
they're
do
making
everything,
every link and every, you know, bit of the chains on the devices. So, so this may be kind of like, you know, it may be like the iPhone where, again, by the third generation or fourth generation, it'll be huge. Although, and then tying it in with the Moore's Law thing, you just wonder what's the limit of how much horsepower could you get on your wrist?
They're doing super tiny computers now. So, like, we talked a handful of years, I think it was called, like, micro dust, or, you know, like the dust of computers, the gray dust, they would just, you know, go everywhere. There are some researchers that are getting computers very, very, very small now to where it's going to possibly, you know, aid the Internet of Things. And it's just, you know, not a lot of computing power, but the fact that it's so tiny is impressive because you put a lot of tiny things in together in parallel and you get something,
I think,
you know, it's got a little bit
quite
neat.
Fashionable with a Raspberry Pi strapped to your arms.
Or someday we'll each get our own, we'll have our own bit from Tron.
Yes. No. Yes, yes. No, 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 no.
We've had at the Geek Gathering, we've had some people strap some electronic digital watches. You know, not digital, not like a Casio, but, you know, like some hand-built, hacked-together things.
The thing that surprises me is that something didn't come out sooner. And if you think about it, take like a, you know, it doesn't work so much with the iPhone 6, but like an iPhone 4S. If you take that and turn it sideways on your wrist, it almost kind of fits the kind of, you know, the sci-fi, you know, gauntlet. You know, I don't know. What would you call that?
Yeah, it used to be called a wearable computer. Now you can have it. You know, with a sweatband and a wristband and an iPhone, you've got your wearable computer.
But if you imagine if you took, though, so you've got, you know, you could make the body a little bit thinner and you could put battery into the band that goes around your wrist. Part.
Call it a power band,
and then you'd have battery life that was better than what, you know, Apple, I think, is really betting on Moore's Law to bail them out, you know, or to help them out going forward with the iPhone, so that the thing can have a battery life that makes sense. You know, the iPhone, it's not because batteries got so much better; it's that the phone got a lot bigger than what saved them on the battery.
Well, unfortunately, battery tech has not progressed like. It's
I
more like wheat production than like transistors.
Can I get my fuel cell yet?
But there may be
that's going to be one of those where there's a jump.
There'll be a jump at some point, but yeah, there's
not. One of these technologies that we talk about that they'll be to market in 2 or 3 years will actually happen in 2 or 3 years and be what it was explained to be in the first place. Although, I want to bet on this more kind of, if you want to have the steampunk, electropunk future. So it's more like capacitor stuff. So you go up to this thing and a bolt of lightning comes out of it and hits your watch to give you enough power to go till the next, like, lightning station to get your thing charged up. Like Lee was talking about with the Tesla charger station, when you plug that thing in and you can literally feel the electricity going into the cramming into the car battery.
I think when Moore's Law does break down, a lot of people are thinking that open source hardware is going to really come around, because right now we've got Arduino, we've got a couple things like that, but when you've maxed out hardware and no one is making money off pushing hardware fast anymore,
yeah,
it becomes
obsolete.
A commodity. You just, yeah, obsolescence is whatever, and it just becomes, you know, a block of wood becomes a block of wood, a PC becomes a PC, it doesn't matter, and that can get really cool.
Because think about most electronic parts, just except for process, you know, there's the certain things, you know, you used to be able to go to Radio Shack and get them. Well, here's something that
you used to be able to go to Radio Shack.
That brings sort of the I think didn't Sprint say they're the ones that are closed are gone.
Yeah.
But the ones that are still open, I think, are going to be Sprint and Radio Shack.
Yeah, they made them even more focused on cell phones than they already were.
Well, did Sprint not feel like they were heavy enough into cell phones? They're like, all right, we need to get someone that really, really knows cell phones. Radio Shack.
But, the tying into the whole processors and other stuff, it's the first thing in Try, Buy, or Fry, so we'll jump in. This one's it has been announced. Now, maybe they're trying to freeze the market because they're announcing it for 2017, but apparently there's going to be a commercial cooking robot where users would be able to select one of 2,000 dishes from their phone, and the robotic hands in the automated kitchen would make it.
That's going to go through an Indiegogo campaign and a Kickstarter campaign and a GoFundMe campaign.
The robotic hands, which are notoriously difficult to create, use 20 motors, 24 joints, and 129 sensors to create the same range of movements that a human hand can make. So they're trying to do the, like, sort of duplicate, and they like motion cap chefs to get the
And then they have the like off the menu recipes, like choke the person closest to you.
or it's going to be like an alien where the mumblety peg knife trick. One of the things apparently that's different about this one is that since it's following what a chef would do, you don't have to do the earlier cop out was, yeah, the robot could make the food, but everything had to be pre-portioned, you know, and done, which that's the part. It's not like everybody goes, yeah, well, I hate the mixing it in the pan and, you know, heating it stuff. What I really love is chopping up, you know, 3 cups of carrots.
Getting all prepared.
And all that. So, although, you know, maybe they should have focused on that part, because if you could just like hand the robot the carrots and the, you know, the work parts, and they hand it back, they can be your sous chef, you know, the first cooked sous chef robot.
So this is designed to kick the Cuisinart out of the kitchen, not go into like commercial kitchens, right? This is destined for the home, is what they perceive this
it
as.
It sounds like commercial or home stuff. You know, early on, they say something about commercial, but they also just talk about it being in your kitchen.
That would be cool if they actually, you know, could imbue the hand with, like, different celebrity chefs. Like, you get the Gordon Ramsay hand and it yells at you. Or it just slaps you.
Or somebody hacks your house and gives you the Guy Fieri. But at present, it's able to knock up a crab bisque, which it creates by replicating the exact movements of a professional chef. The food thing seems to be a growing focus, because there's also been stories about Watson, IBM's Watson, being aimed at recipe creation, like looking for different, you know, it's like, I don't want to be the one who tries when Watson puts out every permutation of what you can put in a, you know, butterscotch, ammonia, yeah. And...
We can either send them after to find new prime numbers or flavors of corn chips no one has ever tried before.
New artificial sweeteners and flavorings that have never been explored before. But, this one, you know, I guess it's an interesting... This is the kind of first step stuff, though, where they record, they motion-capped chefs, and then the robot can basically duplicate those motions in a fully automated kitchen. So I don't know that. I guess I would try it. Apparently, in China, there is a robot that slices noodles.
And this is where it's kind of coming. I don't think there's going to be any one company that is going to be able to perfectly produce a robot. And, you know, like what Apple's trying to do with the watch, where they're doing the links, they're doing everything themselves. I think when we finally get to the point where, you know, hopefully by the time I'm old and I need the help, you know, with service robots like they're doing in Japan, I think it's going to be an amalgamation of parts. Like, you know, this maybe, you know, the cooking hand is the hand that just takes off, and they're the ones that get the price of an articulated hand down to the point where you can put this on a different robot that does something else, you know.
There you go.
All these different parts just trying to kind of come together. This is neat.
It is a big jump from the Roomba to this kind of device. Yeah, imagine the Roomba kitchen cook. It's just smaller and it goes on your counter and moves around randomly.
It's like my mouse occasionally cooking things.
You can have your hamster on it in a shark suit. But
hamster in a shark suit.
Well, because it'd be littler
than
the other kitchen.
I understand. You...
So...
Oh, we get the joke. What's this phone call I see coming in? Is this something we need to pay attention to? Oh, our friend Gary. No, we're not going to talk to Gary right now. He didn't put in a subject line.
Yeah, we need a subject.
So, C-O-N-S.
Conspiracy.
Conspiracy. C-O-N-spiracy. Okay.
Oh. I thought he was saying we're all cons. It's not the prison show. Okay, other try-by or fry. I guess I would put the kitchen robot under tentatively try. But it also could fry.
It could fry.
It could strangle someone out. You talk about, you know, being afraid of hackers and malicious, you know, software. This is what you don't want to get on there. You know, the next thing you know, it's whipping up, you know, a nice little omelet for breakfast, and, you know, 30 seconds later, you're politically assassinated.
Well, yeah, you're giving the robot hands, you know, a knife.
That's not, but I like that. It could make your last meal and then, you know, carry out the rest. It's
it could make you the last
shop.
Meal.
the Silence of the Lambs bot.
I will not stock mine with fava beans or Chianti. I'm just going to take that possibility completely out.
This other one is the other product for try by or fry. Is called SMFX, Smart FX. It's a smart light bulb that you can adjust from your iOS or Android device to dim, brighten, change color, turn off, on or off your light without lifting more than a finger. It's LED, so it has 40,000 hours of use. That's 27 years of normal use. That means not 24/7. That means, you know,
3 hours
on
a
when
day.
It's dark. Yeah, 3 hours a day. It uses 10% of the energy of a standard bulb. It has multicolor channels. Is the thing that's kind of interesting on it. It has RGBW channels for brighter colors. You can turn it on and off from the app. So now you have to find your phone to turn. Now I'm sure it works from the switch too, but this is the thing that I thought might be the compelling piece for it, because this light bulb costs around $50. Just so you know, it's a Bluetooth smart bulb, so it's not on the internet. You pair it with your phone, so that may make it harder for your friends to hack
just
your
the Bluetooth
bulb.
Of things.
But this one has disco mode. To change the light along with the music. I don't know if that means that the music has to be on your...
That over Bluetooth?
It probably picks up on the mic on the smartphone and then transmits it to the LED.
Maybe, or else the music has to come from the phone, so it's like getting it as part of the process
Bluetooth
of it. You can schedule functions and set timers to fit your daily routine. So, this is not inexpensive, but I think it is, you know, this is one of those things where here's where Moore's law affects smart light bulbs.
However, I've seen another smart light bulb like that a couple of years ago. It was 2 to 3 times as expensive. And if you look at a lot of the LED, the cost savings light bulbs, those aren't cheap. Those aren't like, you know, it's the equivalent of buying an incandescent light bulb. Those are 30, 40. They can be, you know. Yeah.
No, but they've gotten a lot cheaper.
Have
though,
they? Right? I haven't bought
them. They don't have disco mode.
No disco mode. That's a deal breaker.
I just bought some that were on sale. 60-watt bulbs, I think, LED bulbs, for $5 a piece. Which, I mean, yeah, that's not as cheap as but they last.
The thing
way
with LED
longer.
Bulbs the thing where you have to be careful is the color temperature of them, because depending on where you're going to use them and how you're going to use them, some of them can be too blue, some of them
don't
can be
use,
too
don't
yellow.
Use Arctic blue in the kitchen.
Oh,
because I did that. I bought fluorescent bulbs one time that were like the bright white, like the blue, like high temperature, and I put them in the kitchen and everything looked pale and washed out, like food looked gross, like it was just
like
bad
Joe's Volcano style.
Yeah, if you really want to blow it, if you're married, get those kind of bulbs and put them in the bathroom fixture where the mirror is. Because then it's that whole dressing room experience every morning for everybody when they get dressed. Do I look like that? And your spouse will kill you the first time she uses it. But, you know, so that the LEDs, that's the thing that's sort of funny to me, is that before it was like when you bought a light bulb, there was, okay, well, there's frosted and clear and
wattage,
some
maybe
of that and the wattage, but the light that came out of them was pretty much, you know, or the yellow ones if you were going to put a bug killer light in your socket.
They also made that, those ones were kind of pink colored.
And you, but you didn't have to think about the, like, color temperature. You didn't
not
have to know
much
what the heck that was.
Black light bulbs. So that's really hard to find velvet posters these days.
But, you know, and the nice part with the thing with this one is with it being adjustable and being $50, one would hope that that means that in the future that all of them will be adjustable so that you can have it for whatever type of light. Tying into, you know, if, remember a few weeks ago on Try By Our Fry, there was what was it, Lux or Flux, the F-Lux, the thing that would change the color temperature of your screen mm-hmm. so that it didn't keep you awake. I could see where you know, a smart bulb, it would be nice if it kind of, as the night went on, had less blue in it.
It needs just a little, if it had like a little base sensor that could detect, you know, like what time it was, you know, without having to have your phone there. That would be
yeah.
excellent for going away on vacation because it could turn your lights on and off and do all kinds of stuff like that. Even individually, make it look like, hey, he's going upstairs. Oh, they're
yeah.
going to the restroom
yeah,
at
2
a.m.
Yeah, the light goes on and off
yeah.
and on. And wake up in the, fake him waking up in the middle of the night.
And then you could have it frantic mode where it's like just like looks like you're running around turning lights on.
And
I'm not going to that house with that guy. Mode. That person's crazy.
Especially if they, and you tie it to turn on the stereo and play some music, and then that ties to the Christmas displays that are synced to the lights.
There you go, it's a little Bugs Bunny. You'll never take me alive, cover.
Have it play the final countdown, and you know, and the lights are going on in different rooms. For every day is a holiday.
Holiday mode, yeah. The Christmas modes could be built in. This is a huge market, you know.
Or just at 2 o'clock in the morning when your house randomly goes into disco mode. I think the smart bulb goes on my try. I don't know. Maybe not this specific one, but. If you own a house and the bulbs in those recessed bulbs in the pots, especially if you have like a great room with the like two-story ceiling or whatever, if you ever have to go up and change those once and you're going to plan to live in that house any longer, put in LEDs because then you don't have to ever for the rest of your natural life climb up there to mess with it or get that weird floodlight bulb changer pole structure
yeah.
thing.
Well, have you seen that they're doing they have these lights and they're synced with certain television shows or movies. So like there's the 12 Monkeys sci-fi series and they have an app that you control these lights with and it changes the color of the lights to match the mood of the show. So your whole room kind of like changes color. So if you're in a, you know, this, if you've watched 12 Monkeys on Sci-Fi, it's got some interesting color saturation going on. It's nothing over the top or anything, but definitely could see like, you know, there's this scene where the time machine is and it's got this beam of blue light that's shooting across the room. So everything's kind of dark and tinted blue. And they kind of demonstrate this in the commercial, that the lights will turn blue.
So is it coming from behind the TV? I've seen some of that where they do the
bulbs,
ambient light.
It's just designed bulbs in whatever lamps you have. Yeah, now I have seen the ones that are built into the TV or you attach to the TV that kind of turn the wall. But you might do that with these lamps or something.
Yeah.
But it's you have them in the room, so they're white lights normally, right? According to this, it looks like they're white lights normally. But if you hit the app and you sync to the show and it's broadcasting, I guess, live, I don't know if it will do it if you DVR'd it, but... You know, but if you sync it to the show, and so as the scenes change, your lights change colors with the show.
Although, so that week you decide not to watch the show, but halfway through, I don't know, the president's address on the current crisis.
Well, you think you have to activate the app.
Okay.
I think
that well, probably. I wonder if it probably has some sort of tie where it's doing. You know, maybe there's something with the app where it's detecting a sound that we can't hear from the broadcast or whatever, so that it would sync up and know that, okay, now, you know, at so many minutes, the lights go blue or...
Yeah, I don't know what it is on my phone, but Jay's got a picture of it. That is kind of neat, mood lighting. I like the idea of the smart light bulbs, and, you know, you get, like, what we had looked at earlier. You get something like that, and you don't have to have a specific product for it. You know, I'm sure there'll be an app that pops up. I know that there's some kind of app. I don't know if it's Plex or what, but on my phone, if it thinks I'm watching a movie or TV in the background, it'll detect that, and it'll want to bring up information about that. So if your smartphone's in the room, and it can just, you know, the same way it would, you know, like a Shazam, you know, that kind of thing where it just, you know, maybe even looks and says, like, okay, what's out now? What's playing right now? Okay, it's none of those. Let's roll back. Let's figure out what it is. And then it, you know, it can sync, and then it can push out whatever it wants to the light bulbs or whatever else is in the room.
Well, plus if it's got the app and you're launching that and watching the show, then it knows what show. It just has to know when in the show to
Yeah, but if it's still listening, it'll sync. It could sync because it'll know kind of where it is. Yeah.
But I guess it would be interesting to find out if you could watch it whenever.
Yeah, and then when we get our smart living rooms, like completely smart living rooms, and everything has an IP address, like your massage chair could, you know, vibrate, like when something scary happens on screen, and the drawers could open up and close, and just the whole house becomes haunted to go with the movie.
There's that certain point. It's like automation, you know. It starts out cool, where it's like, hey, you know, the lights will do, and then. Then it ends up Idiocracy, like, so quick. You know, it goes from, like, that would be the ultimate. You know, I'm just sitting in my chair, and when I want another drink, you know, whether that would be a beer or a soda or whatever, then it'll just, you know, the smart robot will come and give it to me, and the lights will, I don't know, come up so I can open it or whatever. It's a short jump from that to the toilet recliner and Idiocracy.
I think we're eventually going to go and we're going to outgrow our bodies and we're just going to be, you know, minds and we upload ourselves. And we pretty much will be just on these. You know, it'll be like somewhere between Idiocracy and The Matrix. You know, somewhere between the toilet recliner and those little, you know, tubs where we're harvesting our own energy.
Somebody needs to get Mike Judge and the Wachowski brothers, or the Wachowskis, I guess is the way they're referred to now, together to make a movie about the future. And they have to all have, like, sort of equal input.
Yeah, like, that would be really good. Like a Terminator kind of Matrix thing, but the robots are really dumb because we didn't get the AI right. But it's okay because the humans are really dumb, too.
Or maybe they'll do the kind of the cut back and forth thing, like they use it occasionally in movies where the character says, you know, has this great speech. And this, it's sort of like, that's what I thought I was saying. And then they cut to them and they're, you know, usually whacked out on something. And so you cut from the Matrix, you know, and they think they're Neo. And then they cut to the real world and they're a chubby geek like us. Somewhere. All right.
Go, chubby geeks.
And let's see, you know, I guess... We don't have that much time left, but there's time. There's always time for...
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious...
Science! Yeah. Well, so some of these are, if you're a big E.T. fan, are...
They're not going to remake that movie, are they?
No, but if you're a big fan of extraterrestrial civilizations, they've scanned 100,000 galaxies and not found any mega civilizations.
Sure.
That's because apparently the mega civilizations go from galaxy to galaxy like locusts eating... Wait, that's the plot of Independence Day. Back in the 1960s, Russian cosmologist Nikolai Kardashev devised the famous scale that now bears his name, which was a numbering system from 1 to 3 to classify hypothetical alien civilizations according to the amount of energy at their disposal. According to the scale, a K1 civ has captured the entire output of its home planet, which I guess that would be probably a K1, while a K2 civ has tapped into all the power produced by its home star. That's a badass civ, I'll say that. And then the K3 civs, which would be these super civilizations, who have tapped into virtually all of the energy produced by their own galaxy.
That's a big jump from a single sun to, like, all of them in the entire galaxy.
Yeah, although it falls down to sort of what can you observe, at what level can you observe. You do solar system and then galaxy, because they're not the same thing.
I think Sid Meier just got way out of control there towards the end.
But, So with that, you would be able to detect a K3 civilization. You would think you could detect because the according to fundamental thermodynamics, the energy pulled in by a K3 civ must still be radiated away as heat in the mid-infrared wavelengths. These galactic-scale signatures, though far away, would be detectable from Earth. So with that in mind, they looked at 100,000. Penn State recently completed a survey, 100,000 galaxies to see if they could find traces of galaxy-spanning super-civilizations, and the TLDR is...
We didn't find nothing.
No obvious alien-filled galaxies were found. It doesn't mean that there aren't any, because 100,000, unfortunately, based on the number of galaxies, is a drop in the bucket. So there were, all this said, there were 50 galaxies that did feature higher than usual levels of mid-infrared radiation, and they'll have to do further analysis to figure out if that's caused by some natural process or if it's an indication of, I guess, a more than K2 civilization. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Obviously, you know what? Well, think about it. Although it's sort of weird because 2 or 3 years ago, the idea, that we might find water on Mars, liquid water on Mars, was a big deal. And everybody was sort of, wow, is that going to happen? Well, it sounds like this past week it did. They found, they found that at night there is liquid water beneath the surface of Mars, and then that goes, in the heat of the day it goes away, it evaporates, but then it then recondenses or whatever. Which that's pretty mind blowing. But it was a science story. It wasn't a front page. I guess if they'd found little men, that were drinking the water or something, that might have been a bigger deal. Here's another one. Sorry, I'm a fountain of disappointment in science tonight. But there was that the radio signals that were those mysterious radio signals. they were out there, and they were coming at random, and so it was really difficult to figure out kind of where was this from and all that. They called them Peritons. They figured out what it was. It was the Parkes. They were at the Parkes Observatory in Australia is where they were finding these. And they identified microwave ovens at the Parkes site as the source of the signal. Basically, if you're, if you're heating up a cup of coffee or whatever, and the timer's not done and you pull the door open, the microwave shuts off. It's not like you're flooded with microwaves. But there is a burst of that energy that was in the microwave oven that gets released.
That's why I don't do that. I always wait for the complete beeping to stop.
Yeah, and that makes sense. But apparently somebody in Australia didn't.
You can also get poorly shielded microwaves. I've seen microwaves mess with Wi-Fi and stuff like that, just because the radiation it puts off is so dirty that it spreads across all spectrums if it's not really shielded well.
So
you think alien life forms have microwaves and are heating up coffee? That's amazing.
So now the aliens.
Well, it's not coffee, but
if they're smart, their communications will be very quick microwave bursts that we blow off as somebody opening the microwave too fast. But it lets them communicate, so that way they don't get caught by Jeff Goldblum hiding their signal in our satellites. The countdown, There actually is I guess they're working on Independence Day 2, but Will Smith won't be in it. So we'll wait and see on that one. another one. Here, we'll skip to this one because this is a cool positive story. The first color pictures of Pluto have come back. And if, like me, I went, if you go to, I haven't put it up there. Later on tonight, because it's too late for me to copy and paste it and put it in right now, but we'll put the links up to these stories. If you're all, you're thinking, oh, a color picture of Pluto, you'll be able to see some kind of detail. No, it's kind of like I went to the site and you look at it. And
you followed the clickbait.
It's a kind of peach-colored blob with a smaller peach-colored blob next to it, and that is Pluto and its moon Charon.
However, if you look at what they were, you know, like we had 15 years before
that's
that, it was about 8 pixels. Like
we've
it looked
to the point
like
where at least now it's like 100 pixels or something. Or
I think it's a few thousand, isn't it? Oh, it went up by a magnitude. I think
is
of
getting closer though, right? We're gonna get better pictures.
Yeah, this yeah. is just the
no,
first
this
color
is
one.
This is good. It's gonna get. Wait another 100 years.
Yeah, we're so excited.
It's an iPhone 3.
This one, you could if you had a picture of Earth with this level of resolution, you still wouldn't know if there was civilization on the planet. But okay, and then the last blow off thing. Have you ever had the Myers-Briggs test? Like at work?
Yep. Not at work, but yes.
I did have it at work. This was done by a manager who was such a non-clever person that he thought all of us on the team taking the Myers-Briggs test would be a team-building exercise.
We did something similar, but it wasn't Myers-Briggs. It was a company that took Myers-Briggs and branded it to make it their own. It's probably so they could copyright it or something.
Well, the weird thing, you know how when you get the thing is the results on a Myers-Briggs are basically meaningless. There's not any science to back it up. The deal where they go where you're either introverted or extroverted, you know, it's that whole ENTJ or INFP and that kind of stuff. Nobody is binary like that. Everybody falls somewhere between introverted and extroverted. If you were totally introverted or totally extroverted, you know, the 100% kind of thing, you'd probably be in an institution is what it comes down to if you really were like that. So the Myers-Briggs thing is the equivalent of a BuzzFeed quiz, like which house at Hogwarts do you belong in? As far as it telling you anything about yourself or any other person.
It's like, he thought he was IGNTB, but what he found out surprised him.
it's like trying to cut jello.
The thing is, though, when you do get a Myers-Briggs thing, because so the HR people, you know, gave us a Myers-Briggs, then went over the results with us. So they talk about
so
you
what,
know,
what did
means.
It say you were?
Oh, mine was like, I think ENTJ. Oh. You know, I think, you know, the being extroverted, yeah, I'm on a radio show, I talk a lot.
I was an INTP.
And the J, judging, I think you can pretty well listen to the show and figure that I have opinions about things and I'll put them out there. But the weird thing was this manager, this bizarre manager, I think he lied on his Myers-Briggs because then when they described what kind of person he had, you know, he had his, and I don't remember what it was anymore, but when they were describing sort of the opposite of what he was, you know, on the wheel, they have the you know, different sides to it and all that. His stuff was kind of almost completely the opposite of what I knew him to be. And so it's like, you know, there's nothing stopping you from giving the answer you think somebody might want on the Myers-Briggs. But
well, yes, I do like to take charge and make quick decisions with authority.
Hey, I found the pixels. So the old Pluto images, I guess in 1994... One pixel was 200 kilometers. We got better pictures in 2002, but they got worse. One pixel was 540 kilometers. When it makes its closest pass in July, one pixel will be 70 meters. So we're going to get to see really, really detailed stuff, at least, you know, compared to the stuff from the...
Well, before they were so far, they weren't color either, right? Or they didn't have enough pixels.
No color, yeah, it was just grayscale.
Well, but isn't it weird? When you think Pluto, what color do you think Pluto would be? It's like white, like
tan.
The moon.
Tan, yeah, kind of Mickey Mouse colored, a little more yellow.
I would have thought like the moon, you know, though, so basic sort of white or gray and chalky powdery. So it's kind of interesting that far away from the sun that it's got color and that it's a different one. See, I would have thought it was white because I've got white privilege. No, I'm more from the moon, not from the light. It has to look like me, my rickets.
I think we should go now.
That's it, we're out of time.
Hate mail can be sent to
Geek Mouth. Geek Mouth.
All right, you've been listening to Technology
All
Bites.
All you peach-colored people can complain. He said white. Anyways, I'm Peter Hughes.
He's so busy backpedaling, he ran past me introducing myself.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. Well, welcome to Technology Bites.
Perfect show.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Clifton.
I'm Barrett.
And he's
out of here.
Mark your calendar for Saturday, May 9th, when accomplished singer-songwriters Joe Ely, Ruthie Foster, and Paul Thorne take the stage at the Crichton Theater in downtown Conroe for a fantastic night of storytelling in the round. Grammy Award winner Joe Ely is a mesmerizing live performer who shared the stage with the likes of Bruce Springsteen, The Clash, The Chieftains, and Lyle Lovett. Fellow Texan Ruthie Foster is a high-octane performer of blues, folk, and soul music who comes from a long line of gospel singers and has been nominated for multiple Grammy Awards. Wisconsin-born Paul Thorne was raised in the Mississippi Delta in the famed town of Tupelo. He pairs his formidable guitar skills with a soulful voice as he moves from gospel to blues to rock. Don't miss Joe Ely, Ruthie Foster, and Paul Thorne May 9th at the Crichton Theater in downtown Conroe. For tickets, call 936-441-7469, extension 201. Visit soundsoftexasmusicseries.com for more details. Presented by the Friends of Conroe, a Montgomery County nonprofit organization, and KPFT Houston.
Oh, it's Saturday.
Hello, my friends. This is Rick Izquierdo, along with Cleotis Saturday. And Buck. Welcome you to tune in every Saturday on KPFT 90.1 FM at 9 o'clock until noon for the Lone Star Jukebox. Roots rock, Americana, country music at its best. Great interviews, and we always have some great giveaways. Join us every Saturday to kick off your weekend on the Lone Star.